This is The Human
and the Machine,
brought to you by Editorial Intelligence in association with Vodafone.
Welcome to The Human and the Machine. I'm Julia Hobsbawm.
And I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, we'll be looking at...
When it comes to the human and the machine and rare disease, then it's us humans who have a value and have an ability to try and forge a way forward and not let the machines just get on with it.
And we'll be discussing...
If you don't build the technology around the patient, around the human, around the person who's going to be using it, around the clinicians who are going to be using it, and the way that they interact with their patients, then you can end up actually, I think, potentially diminishing hope because you're so ruled by the technology.
As well as our regular features on the best and worst of tech.
You know those articles, you know, six amazing things you didn't know about the Grand Canyon? I can't stand it. I think it is the worst, most lazy kind of journalism in the world.
That's all ahead right here on The Human and the Machine. Stay with us. You're listening to The Human and the Machine with me, Julia Hobsbawm, and I'm joined by a very special guest, someone I've known for a long time, someone who is at the absolute forefront of the way humans use machines and technology in the area of health. She is Jessica Morris, and if I tell you that we've just passed National Cancer Survivors Day, Jessica, you can introduce yourself and tell us why that applies to you.
Yes, my name's Jessica Morris and Julia and I go back a long, long way. My life took a very dramatic turn, January 2016. Up until that moment, life was pretty good. I'd moved to New York in 2006. I was 52, SVP and partner at Flashman Hillard, which is a very prestigious global PR firm, three fabulous kids, great husband, lots of friends. And I was hiking in upstate New York in January 2016. And I started to feel very odd. And I couldn't have put it into words. It was such an odd feeling. I'd never had it before. I had a very odd sensation of not being able to articulate how I felt. There was just a disconnect between my brain and my desire to talk and my ability to do so. And suddenly I had a seizure and I passed out. 2 days later, I had an MRI, and the next day I had brain surgery, and 2 weeks later I was given the diagnosis, and I have the worst possible kind of brain cancer called glioblastoma. It only comes as a grade 4. It's the same kind of cancer that took the life of Tessa Jowell. It's the same cancer that took the life of Beau Biden, of Ted Kennedy. It threatens the life of Senator McCain. And it threatens mine. And I see and have seen since then that the solution for people like me lies absolutely in the human, but absolutely also in the tech and combining those two. And that's what I've been working on ever since January 2016.
What I'd like to jump to is the nonprofit that you founded called Our Brain Bank, so that the listeners understand just that harnessing, that marriage of the human and the machine that you've effected. Tell us, what is Our Brain Bank?
Our Brain Bank is a innovative nonprofit. We have a very clear mission. Our mission is to turn glioblastoma from being considered a terminal condition to being considered treatable. But what makes us completely a world first is that we believe the best way to do that is to use the power of the patient. And by that I mean not just getting all people like me to go and march in front of the White House and the House of Commons and say we need more research money, but to use the power and the influence that patients have and the desperation patients have to power through and make tech our servant in finding a way through. So what we do is we have a app, the Our Brain Bank app. It's free in the US and it's coming to the UK soon. And it allows people like me to manage our disease by tracking our symptoms. We can input our symptoms, how we're feeling each day. Are we feeling sick? Have we got a headache? Are we feeling depressed? How much exercise are we taking? There are 10 symptoms we can self-input every day. And then we can track that over time. So we can go to our clinicians, which is probably every couple of months or so. When the doctor says, well, how have you been feeling? Instead of trying to remember 8 weeks ago, I can say, well, I think I was feeling this, but here's the evidence. And they can see. And that means a couple of things. It means that I'm more on top of managing my disease, and my doctor is much better able to help me with those symptoms. At the same time, it provides perhaps the most important kind of therapy of all, which is hope. Because my data will be pooled with that of everybody else using the app. And that will be de-identified in a secure database and aggregated and made freely available to any qualified glioblastoma medical researcher in the world. And as we know, increasingly, patient data is the sort of medical currency of our age. It's very problematic in many areas, and many people are trying to crack this nut. The way that we're cracking it, and we think this is going to be, has a good chance of working, is that it's going to be patients taking charge of their data, patients accessing it, and patients making the decisions.
How has it taken this long? We're sort of in the closing teenage years of the 21st century. I mean, what memo have I missed here about technology being used to harness real lived experience in medicine? Or has it been happening, but just not around brain cancer?
There are a number of sites and actually lots and lots of initiatives. And in fact, the app that we use is made by a company called U-Motif, and they've used it in over 100 one-off studies. What's different are a couple of things. One is that the disease I have, glioblastoma, is so rare and it's so complex and it's so heterogeneous that it hasn't attracted the kind of research funding, and there haven't been enough patients, literally enough patients. We have a median survival of 14 months from the moment of diagnosis. So many people die very quickly. So we just have lacked that patient body to really push for change. Most research funding, which will go into things like apps, will be either for cancer as a whole, which doesn't really interest somebody like me because I don't have anything in common with somebody with a stage one form of cancer. That's treatable, that's curable, that's a problem that can be solved. So many of those sites don't speak to me, the patient. In other words, I think where we're going to be more successful is that we're more targeted to the reality of the people living this experience. I'm not a patient. I'm somebody with glioblastoma.
I mean, it's a very remarkable initiative that you've undertaken, and you're sitting in front of me looking as fit as a fiddle, having completely defied the medical odds to date. But you have been very assisted by technology. You're wearing a pair of headphones on your head, but actually the last few times I've seen you, you've been wearing really what I can only describe as a contraption, an electrical contraption on your head. So the machine has been helping you combat this cancer for quite some time. What have you been wearing on your head for the last couple of years?
I've been very fortunate in that my medical insurance in the US has covered me to wear something called the Optune device made by a company called NovaCure. And this is really an extraordinarily innovative device. It's a fascinating story, actually. There was a guy in Israel who, when he was a student, couldn't decide whether to study engineering or medicine. So he applied to do both and medicine came up. But he was always had this interest in engineering. And when he retired, he drove his friends mad because he didn't know what to do with himself. And they said, well, why don't you go and dust off some of those old ideas you have in your basement? And one of them was about electricity and cancer.
What was his name?
He was called, he is called Yoram Palti. And he had always been aware that, and we know this, we know that electricity interacts with the particles within cancer cells. So what he basically did is create this device. You put a series of sticky arrays on your head, and in these sticky arrays are electrodes, and they transmit an electronic tumour-treating fields into your brain. And it's a bit like one of those mouse alarms you might use to deter mice from eating in your house. So my healthy cells don't hear this frequency, but the particles within the cancer cells do. And what it means is that when that frequency hits them, at the point that the cancer cells are trying to divide, the particles go, what's that? So it slows up their rate of reproduction and it kills some of them. So it's completely brilliant. And it's really interesting because it's not a chemical. It wasn't developed through the usual medical way. Many people in the medical profession were very suspicious of it at first. But the data is pretty compelling. And what it shows is that if you are newly diagnosed, as I am, which means I've got the cancer, so far it hasn't recurred, it means that my median survival at 5 years goes from 5% to something like over 30% if I wear it on my head over 90% of the time for 9 months.
Which you did.
I wore it for about 15 months, very happily. I mean, it is cumbersome and there are wires and the company know that, but it's a really patient-centered company and they've been fantastically good to me and many other people at helping us wear this device. And now they're trialling it in all sorts of other solid tumour types.
I know this is slightly off topic, but I remember you flew over the Atlantic when you just started wearing this device. And I was frankly terrified that they would think there was a terror threat because you were walking into an airport, you know, covered in wires. I mean, just on a basic human interest level, how did you handle that? How did your family, did you phone ahead? Did you say, I'm about to walk into an airport with a head full of wires?
I went armed with letters from my doctor, from the company. And you have to, it's not just the thing that you wear on your head with all these wires, but it comes with this kind of special suitcase that looks a bit like a gun case, you know. So it is a bit terrifying. In fact, it was much easier to travel than I thought, but there was one really poignant moment. And it was just at the height of, there were various bombs going off in various capitals of the world. Always you go through the x-rays and I'm always stopped and this case is searched. The guy searching it, he looked up at me just before he opened it and he said, could this hurt me?
Oh, sweetie.
I said, no, I'm the one hurt. Don't worry, this is all about healing. And I thought that was really sad. That's more about, you know, we're living in a crazy age. We've got these incredible innovations to try and to keep people like me alive at the same time as we've got technology being used to kill so many people.
But what's amazing is the sort of way in which you've absorbed the reality that you have become a human who is more aligned than most to machines. I mean, of course, medicine is full of people that get hooked up to dialysis machines or people that have pacemakers embedded. I mean, you're not literally the first patient, but you're the first patient of a kind, aren't you? I mean, how many people are walking around the world with these headsets on, do you think? 100, 200?
The Optune device, the longest anybody's worn it, I think, is as a guy in Chicago who's been wearing it for about 11 or 12 years. So it was only approved for people like me who are newly diagnosed in October 2015, literally a few months before I was diagnosed. So it's really, really, really new. And it's incredibly expensive. The company went through the kind of absolute gold standard of clinical trial process because they knew that this would be greeted with suspicion by the medical profession. And that means, you know, they spend a lot of money going through that process. So it does cost a lot to wear it. And again, I am very lucky. I live in New York. I happen to have very good medical insurance. So it covers the cost, which is $21,000 a month. And that at the moment means it's really hard for people in the UK and many other markets to be able to benefit from it. And I really hope that situation changes soon.
One of the things that's always marked you out over the 25 plus years that I've had the pleasure and luck to know you, Jessica, is that you're a campaigner. Do you think that your natural campaigning flair and instinct, you wanted to change the world as long as I've known you, now you're changing the medical world, has that helped you focus on an enormously difficult task, which is both surviving and creating something that other people can participate in?
Absolutely. I mean, for me, setting up our brain bank is the best therapy of all the ones I take. I've taken a lot. I've been on chemotherapy for 2 whole years, which is much longer than most people are. I've been on immunotherapy, a drug called nivolumab or Opdivo, again, for 2 whole years. I've worn the electronic hat for about 15 months. I've taken cocktails of supplements and followed the ketogenic diet and intermittent fasting. My approach to this diagnosis was with a really aggressive cancer, you got to hit it aggressively. And even if I don't know how all these treatments might impact in my head, better to have more soldiers in there on my behalf than less. I've found enormous solidarity and camaraderie from the patients out there, the fellow travellers. And it's really interesting. When I first had the idea for our brain bank and using the app, my neuro-oncologist was really supportive, but his colleagues were saying, you know, people with glioblastoma, they're not going to want to use this app. Most of them are older. They're in a much worse situation than Jessica, which is true. Many people have had real deficits from the surgery, or the tumour was much larger when it became apparent, or it's inoperable. And they might find it really hard to tolerate the chemotherapy. That is true. But I have to say, go on Facebook, punch in the words glioblastoma, and you will find there are more than 10 groups for patients and for carers. And this is a desperate community. I'm desperate. They're desperate. So that desperation really gets you over that.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, actually, because remember when Facebook started to experience its significant dip in trust and its fall from grace in 2018, which may or may not recover. You defended the social network for the special interest groups such as people with glioblastoma. It's been a bit of a lifeline for you, hasn't it? The solidarity and the shared experience for something that is so specialist.
Absolutely. If you have a rare condition and it's really serious, at first, I didn't actually want to connect with other people. I found it too difficult. But gradually, as time went on, I really wanted to. And there aren't that many people you're going to meet locally with glioblastoma. So actually, where can you meet? And Facebook has been incredibly important for me and for many people on there. I've formed really, really firm friendships. We now have a patient advisory board where people on Facebook who are really interested, we now have our own set of virtual meetings, thanks to technology. That just wouldn't have happened otherwise. I've got this problem. The Optune device I can't actually wear anymore because the immunotherapy drug that I take has caused an allergic reaction in my body, in my scalp, to the gel on the electrotherapy pads. Now, that relationship is not monitored. It's not required to be monitored by the companies or the FDA, but it's happened. And I've been seeing the very best dermatologists and neuro-oncologists in the world who can't help me with this. We've tried all sorts of treatments. Guess where I got the best advice? From somebody on the NovaCure Facebook group, set up by the first patients who were wearing the device. And they had a really good idea about using a very commonly available, it's a sort of dermatological cling film called Tegaderm. So it's not only important for solidarity and friendship, it's also incredibly important for practical and swapping notes.
And I like this story because the human and the machine is basically biased towards saying that humans are better than machines, in effect. The reality is the default position is the human knows best. But I think it is important to recognise that what you're describing is a true harnessing of both together. I just want to finish by saying that I think there is one form of treatment that you have benefited from and we have benefited from watching you have, other than your friendships and your family, and that is your amazing collection of non-machine scarves. Do you have the largest beautiful scarf collection in silk and cotton in the planet?
Absolutely, yes, and I can really proudly say that. I have to say, now I'm not wearing the device, that will be supplemented with hats, more hats, and perhaps some wild wigs. I'm quite enjoying being bravely bald at the moment, but I can see the opportunity for some really cool hats.
Well, the word inspiration is overused, not in your case. Jessica Morris, thank you for joining us.
This is the Human and the Machine.
This edition of The Human and the Machine is brought to you in association with Vodafone, with whom we also collaborate on a series of pop-up symposiums in Europe. If you fancy the idea of joining us, go to thehumanandmachine.com, have a look at what's in store, and perhaps you too can join us. You're listening to The Human and the Machine, and I'm Julia Hobbs-Bormann. Today in the studio here in London's sunny King's Cross, I have two guests to talk about health and technology. One of them is Jessica Morris, who you heard from earlier in this programme, the founder of Our Brain Bank. The second is Dr. Natalie Banner, who leads the Understanding Patient Data Initiative at Wellcome Trust. Wellcome is the second largest medical science charitable foundation in the world, second to the Gates Foundation. She's a philosopher of psychiatry by training, but she now, as I've just said, leads the Understanding Patient Data at Wellcome. Natalie, hello. Jessica, hello.
Helen.
Hi.
So what I'd like to talk about is the question of technology and patients. Natalie, what is patient-led lead at Wellcome? What's the job? You've only just started it, haven't you?
Yes, I've been working on this initiative for a little while, but I've just stepped up to lead it. So Understanding Patient Data is an initiative that's hosted at Wellcome, and the aim of it is to support better conversations about how health data can be used for purposes beyond individual care. And most people, you know, that the data that's collected in their health record is used for their own care, but they don't necessarily know or understand what the value of that data is, particularly when it's pooled and aggregated across many, many people, and how that can potentially be used for all sorts of things. So, for example, for research to understand disease better, for ensuring patient safety for new drugs, for evaluating NHS policies, for commissioning services. And there's all sorts of ways that data could be pooled and used. And Understanding Patient Data is trying to help the conversations about how that could be used so people can understand the benefits, but they're also aware of things like the risks and what safeguards, how the data is protected and that sort of thing.
Was there a trigger moment or a particular case that prompted Wellcome to start shifting some of its significant resources to this direction? I mean, why now?
Well, we've been working in this area for quite some time, and I hate to mention it, but the care.data debacle, which I think was its official title in the end.
Explain what
really,
that is.
Really triggered this.
For listeners in Idaho or India.
So a few years ago, there was an attempt by the government to link up data that's held within GP records with data that's held within hospitals.
In the UK?
In the UK, in England. Now, there's really good reasons for doing this, because at the moment, hospital data is kept completely separately from GP data. So you have no idea about how patients progress through the healthcare system from primary care to hospitals and back again. And so it was a nice idea. Unfortunately, it wasn't very well handled and implemented. And immediately there was a public backlash when it was announced, because there were some failure to answer some very basic questions about, well, who's using this data? How is it being controlled? Who's accessing it? What are they using it for? There were lots of concerns about the idea of companies, for example, accessing the data. And because those questions couldn't be answered, there was a real backlash, and
so
actually the programme got shut down.
Privacy concerns. Which now in 2018, in the era of GDPR, which has just come into force, almost seems quaint, doesn't it, those concerns?
I don't think it is. I think when it comes to health data, unlike other data that we share, you know, social media and so on, your health data is collected in the context of a very trusted relationship between the doctor and the patient. It's characterised by confidentiality. That is the absolute bedrock of our healthcare system. You have to be able to trust that when you're talking to your doctor, that information is being held within in confidence. And that's a really sacred bedrock of healthcare. So your health data is very sensitive. People feel very protective over it. And so I do think it does feel slightly different to other forms of data.
Jessica, what do you think about that? Because you've created a patient-led data app, and you are saying that, broadly speaking, fellow patients of glioblastoma brain cancer are welcoming being able to share. But do you recognise some of Natalie's accounts of concern?
We were very concerned about it. I think many members of the board of Our Brain Bank anticipated that people, particularly in the US, would be really concerned about potential privacy breaches. I didn't feel that was so much the case, because I think if you've got such a severe disease, quite frankly, you want people to use your data because you want a cure to be found. And if it's not going to be in time for you, then at least it could be for those who come after you. So you're coming at privacy through a very different lens. What was interesting is that we did a survey of people with glioblastoma to inform what symptoms, what content we would have on the app. We needed about 50 responses. The doctors thought that would take us about 3-4 months to get that. It's quite a long survey. And we asked a lot of questions about privacy concern. I put that survey out on about 4 GBM glioblastoma sites on Facebook on a Monday morning. I had 115 fully completed questionnaires sent back 24 hours later. Right. And there wasn't a single major concern raised about privacy. Now, we are regulated in the sense that patients, when they sign up to the Our Brain Bank app, are invited to provide an e-consent to their data. We also have an IRB, in Independent Review Board certification. So as safe as you can be, we are. But we all know about the discussions about things like Russia meddling in the US election and other places, that you would be a fool to say that it is completely, utterly 150% certain.
So, Natalie, understanding patient data, how much of that is kind of new technological kit and how much of it is new behaviours around technology that's been around for ages?
It's definitely a little bit of both. What we realised is we're starting from a pretty low base of awareness and understanding. So even for using data for the purposes of, say, compiling information about waiting times, people don't necessarily know that their data could be used for those sorts of purposes. So we're starting from that base of low awareness as it stands, and then you factor in new technologies and it gets even more complicated. So we're looking both at the current uses of patient data, but also trying to get one step ahead, look to the horizon and say, well, how are new technologies such as artificial intelligence going to affect healthcare? How are they going to affect the way that data could be used for research purposes, but also by patients themselves? So we're trying to do a little bit of both.
And your role is fundamentally a policy role, is that right?
It's policy and it's communication. So one thing we're really conscious of is we don't just want to go out there and say to patients and the public, look, don't worry, your data is safe, this is the way it's being used, it's really exciting. We also want to look to the system, to the NHS, to policymakers and so on, to say, look, if you're going to be using this data, you've got to be trustworthy. You need to show people they have good reason to have confidence that their data is being used appropriately, responsibly, ethically, and that it's protected. So we have that dual-facing role.
One of the things that bothers me about the way humans use technology, this is again turning out to be the show in which I'm a little bit more on the tech side than the human side, is there's a lot of ineptitude about joining up in medicine. I remember when a member of my family was very ill and very old at a hospital they had been treated at for many years, and each and every time they were admitted, the hospital, a major London teaching hospital, appeared incapable of joining up the patient data they had. And it was incredibly distressing and health impeding for the patient. That's a human error, isn't it? That's a human attitude.
Yes, it's certainly a human attitude issue, and it's an issue of actually having that long view and investing in the resources and the technologies to be able to provide, for example, electronic health records. In the NHS, we just don't have that yet, and it's astonishing that we're still using paper records, for example. We're getting there. There is a commitment from government that everyone will be able to access their patient records online soon, and the NHS is undergoing a sort of massive transformation to become more digitally savvy, but it's taking time.
Yes, anyone who's had a baby on the NHS knows the sight of a frantic medic at 11 o'clock at night leafing through somebody else's handwriting from 6 months ago and trying to interpret it. It would have been much better if they could look at a screen. Mm. However, what of course happens when and if there's an outage and the patient data could be lost or corrupted or compromised? I mean, is the ethics of the veracity of patient data, not so much the privacy? I mean, for example, a celebrity or a political figure, is there a risk to somebody? Jessica, you want to say something about that. I mean, does that worry you about the corruptibility, the political use of patient data at any point?
I think it is a worry, and I can quite see why that it's important to take those things into account. But I think what's really interesting is if we look to the future, the potential way in which tech can help patients, we're only starting to really think about that. So there was some really interesting research in the US last year by a neurologist called Ethan Bash. And he did a trial where he gave patients a digital device and he asked them to use that every day, and that it would be looked at and reacted upon by their nurses and their doctors every day in real time. And what it showed, this just tentative early stage research, was that that led to a change in outcome. So that's where you have humans and tech working really, really closely together. And just to do that alone, you're seeing a change in outcome. You're seeing people actually living longer. So of course there are concerns about corrupt data, but look at the potential.
Jessica, in your earlier interview on the programme, you talked about hope, and hope being a driver and a healer. I wonder whether it's also confidence, isn't it? What do both of you feel about the psychological element of the mix. You know, we've talked about the human and the machine, but let's dig in a little bit. Natalie, I'm particularly interested in your view as a former philosopher of psychiatry. What's the role of hope and confidence?
Hope absolutely plays an astonishing role, and I think Jessica articulated beautifully earlier how much of a difference that it can make to people when you connect with others experiencing similar things to you, when you can seek advice and so on from other people. I think hope has an absolutely astonishing role, and that's something that could potentially be overlooked by the introduction and development of a lot of tech in healthcare, because sometimes there's a tendency to be driven by the tech, to think, oh, look, we can get some shiny new things, they're going to make a difference to the healthcare system, and that those are the solution. And the problem is, if you don't build the technology around the patient, around the human, around the person who's going to be using it, around the clinicians who are going to be using it, and the way that they interact with their patients, then you can end up actually, I think, potentially diminishing hope because you're so ruled by the technology.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think it's just fantastic to hear that. Our brain bank is very much centered around the patient, because we are using universal design principles to say that if you design things around the patient, then you're going to ask yourselves more relevant and better questions. At the moment, we have a system in medicine. If you look at from research and funding right through to the institutions, regulatory, hospital, and so on, the professions, which are not designed around the patient sufficiently well. And we have an opportunity with tech to realign that so that the patient comes first. That will force one to ask better questions and hopefully get better solutions. If you were designing the National Health Service or the FDA in the US for the first time now, it would look very different. As it is, I have a disease that has a median survival of around 14 to 15 months. The average time it takes to get a new treatment from inception right through to clinical trial and then onto the market is three, five, 10 times longer than my average lifespan. The median survival point for my condition. So that's just fundamentally wrong. If your starting point is what's going to work for the patient, then the technology suits the patient and not the other way around.
So the message I'm taking away from this discussion is that technology and machine learning, machine-led solutions to health are critical, crucial and welcome, but they are nothing without the application to the human experience and the human tweaking. Jessica, you've got a very human finger up, as in you want to speak. Last word to you, Jessica.
I was really struck. It was about 6 weeks after my diagnosis. I was in complete shock and I was Googling furiously. And I came across an extraordinary piece of reading. And if anybody here is listening who's interested in or suffering or living with some terrible disease like me or knows somebody close to you, then check out Stephen Jay Gould. Stephen Jay Gould was a paleontologist. He was a professor at Harvard. He died of cancer, but he survived a previous cancer, not the one that he died from. And he wrote this incredible essay called The Median Is Not the Message. And it explodes the myth about statistics. And for statistics, read data. We used to call about stats, now we talk about data, but it's the same thing. It's about hard, objective measures. And he also talks, even as somebody rooted and trained in these objective measures, he talks about hope and how, for some reason that we don't understand, patients who are able to have a positive attitude, who are able to take actions, who are able to try and control their disease and not let their disease control them, they don't know why. He doesn't know why, but for some reason they tend to, not in every case, they tend to do a bit better. I don't mean that as a criticism for people who choose not to try and combat their disease. I wouldn't ever dream of passing judgment on anybody. But what I would say is that when it comes to the human and the machine and rare disease, then it's us humans who have a value and have an ability to try and forge a way forward and not let the machines just get on with it.
Jessica Morris, Natalie Banner, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
This is The Human
and the Machine,
brought to you by Editorial Intelligence in association with Vodafone.
Sometimes we love tech, sometimes we hate it. We've compiled some of our contributors' thoughts on their techno heaven and their techno hell.
Hi, my name is Alice Thwaite, and I'm the founder of the Echo Chamber Club.
I really love the idea of being able to own as much of my data as possible. And so my idea of Techno Heaven is the ability to program my own hardware so that I can start to host my own emails, websites. And actually, incidentally, I got an amazing present for my birthday, which is a Raspberry Pi, which means that you can do just that. So I suppose it's becoming a heaven on earth. Or is that too cheesy to say?
I'm Carl Miller. My techno hell are listicles. You know those articles, you know, six amazing things you didn't know about the Grand Canyon. I can't stand it. I think it is the worst, most lazy kind of journalism in the world. Even worse when you have to actually click through each time to see the next one. I just would get rid of them, all of them, immediately.
Sometimes it just gets too much and you have to switch off. Here's Techno Shabbat.
I'm Jeff Malgan, Chief Executive of Nesta, and I regularly do a techno Shabbat, switch everything off, mobile phones, internet, go a day or a week. I've never quite gone a month, but I should do at peace, disconnected, and able to recharge the batteries.
If you'd like to know more about anything discussed, head to our website, thehumanandmachine.com. This show is brought to you by Editorial Intelligence and supported by Vodafone. It was recorded at Spiritland in London's King's Cross. The researcher is Alice Fielden. The studio producer is George McDonough. The executive producer is Julia Hobsbawm. And I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.